We bought it right and then leveraged it right. It's one thing to buy it right, but it's another thing to leverage it right. So what happened was when the market turned in 08, a ton of people were losing their houses because what they were doing is refinance, buying a house, fixing it up, refinancing it, and pulling their $10,000 to $15,000 off of it and living off of it.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Dan Butler is a long-term buy and hold real estate investor in single-family homes, small multifamily apartments, and commercial buildings. Dan currently invests in solid business operators, utilizing his manufacturing operations and business building experience to partner with business owners to scale their businesses. Dan, welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. This is a long time in coming for the two of us. Gosh, I think we met when I first moved here, actually to Memphis, what, 8, 9 years ago?
It's been a while.
And it's funny because I was just getting started in real estate. I'd never even heard. I had no idea what a property management company even was. I was looking for somebody, and that's how I got connected with you guys. Then it was my second house I'd ever bought. I'm like, I don't know what to do with this.
I'll hire by Rhodes, right? Rhodes College, wasn't it?
Right. Holy smokes. Of the thousands of homes that you have, I must have either left an indelible impression one way or the other, probably in the negative, but that's impressive.
I can't remember names. I'm not very good with names, but somehow I remember houses. I don't know what it is, but I guess it's just because of my blood. I don't know.
I guess, man. That's funny. I was talking to somebody the other day about that because I used to track foreclosures here in the city. And then a buddy of mine ended up buying it several purchases later, and I could spit out his address. It takes over, I'm off of this. And I just remembered the address. I'm like, dude, I haven't looked at that house in 7 years. Right. Like, it just stuff you, but I can't remember what I'm supposed to be doing today. So that's hilarious. Hey, let's jump in here. The same three questions I ask every person who comes on this show. Can you quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? How did you get there?
So basically, I went to engineering school, Clemson University, and was in manufacturing operations experience, but I had a mentor in high school and college that invested in real estate. We were talking about earlier before the show, like I had a yard care business and I was always helping him. I was kind of the grunt guy. And he just taught me about wealth creation. He had a bunch of rentals and it was kind of in his family. So I knew all through college, I was just wanted to do real estate somewhere in the journey. And I remember, this is going to date me a little bit, but I remember reading Nothing Down by Robert Allen, Nothing Down in the 90s. He's got like 2000s and he probably has 2010s by now, but that was the book I remember reading, which took me on the trajectory. And you're going to laugh at all the houses and apartments and commercial buildings. I've never put money down on a project. So that was the basis and the foundation of getting started. So anyway, moved to Memphis, had no idea that Memphis was the mecca it was around the, what we call the rent to price ratio, where you know, take the rent divided by the purchase price and the ratio there is stellar, top five in the nation for years. I don't think it is anymore, just how hot it's gotten. We can talk about that if you want. So moved here, was here a few years, finally found an apartment to buy, bought a small multifamily apartment and learned a ton of lessons, underinsured, no renter's insurance, and really just got through it and said, you know what, if I can get through this, I can get through about anything. I mean, there was 8 units burned up. I was $100,000 underinsured on what their payout was. I was 27 years old. I had no money to speak of. And just, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. And so got through that. And I was doing the BRRRR strategy before BRRRR was the acronym. I wish I had coined it
right
before. So just started doing the BRRRR strategy over and over. And I had a manufacturing career along with the buy and hold of multifamily and single family and a few commercial buildings, and just did that for several years and then built other businesses out of that. So,
wow. So at some point you transitioned out of the manufacturing career and decided to go full-time into real estate. What was that transition like and why did it make sense to do that?
Ooh, that's a great question. My wife wanted me to do it 2 years before I did. And this is a good key thing I would think for your audience is like, she just saw my passion and drive for real estate. And she just believed in me personally, but I was more, I wanted to get the house paid off. I wanted my bills to be, you know, cars. I didn't want any notes of any sort besides asset, income producing assets. So about 2 years before I quit, I kind of had a plan, just executed that plan to get things paid off and paid down. And my goal was to live on like 40 grand a year. That was kind of what my thought was and just jumped in. And so my business partner at the time, He's a CPA, CFA. I was engineering operations, and we saw 1 + 1 = 3. And as you know, we created a property management company, a maintenance company, brokerage for helping investors buy and sell, the lending business, and then finally the virtual staffing business, which kind of doesn't fit in the vertical integration piece, but it's a business service. And we've always been our biggest customer. If you think, we were always the biggest property management client. We were always the property manager was the biggest client of the maintenance company and go on down the road. So that's kind of how we built the business, is we started with being the first customer and built it out from there. So
that's intriguing. I mean, and for those of you who aren't listening, Dan's being pretty humble, or are listening rather. Golly, hopefully you're listening. Like,
hope you're listening.
Otherwise, or was thinking, for those of you who don't know Dan, he's being very humble in what they've done. You guys have grown and built some amazing businesses with a lot of houses. I mean, I think at one point, or maybe even now, you guys had managed thousands of homes at a time, and you own the lion's share of that, which was a heck of a portfolio to build. You did that mostly on the single family side, right?
Yeah. So probably we got up to 900 units and probably 300 of those are multifamily, small commercial, and then the rest are single family homes throughout the what I call the West Tennessee region and then North Mississippi.
So one of the things that we hear on this show, maybe you can debunk this myth for us, is that single family is not scalable. Somehow you were able to scale it. How was that done?
Great question. I mean, it starts with one. As you know, I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of clients over the years and people that wanted to get into real estate. And one, I started with apartment building, but then after that, I pivoted and did single family, but just rinse and repeat. But what I found was, this is part of a bigger discussion around your balance sheet. I wanted my assets high, liabilities low, and then having that W-2 early on really helped me when I was transitioning because of the debt service coverage ratio. But all that to say, think about this. In the buying world, there's thousands of people that will want to buy one house, two houses, one at a time, but there's not many. The pool goes down of people that are willing to buy 5 at a time or 10 at a time. I don't know if I told you this, but we're buying 200 in Jackson in December. So to me, that's a significant portfolio size, especially nowadays. It's hard to find that. But years ago, that would have stressed me out. But when you create the systems behind you to take care of it, you just plop it in the system and go. So I think that's where people don't understand, like the demographics. You're not bidding on a bunch of as many people when you're trying to go after their packages. And I just think that spreads your risk. If you buy, say, these 200 homes, they're all over the city of Jackson, Humboldt, Dyersburg. So they're spread over 50 miles. Of course, thankfully, we have two offices that kind of hone that in a little bit, but that helps spread your risk. Say a hurricane comes through or a tornado or whatever that natural disaster could be or whatever, a fire, those kind of things. You're mitigating your risk in that concept.
I like that. And it's always one of those things where I've always said you want to go where nobody else is or everybody else can't afford to play.
That's right. Right? Zig when others are zagging. That's what I always say.
Exactly. It sounds like early on you started looking at portfolios, be it 2 to 4 to 6 houses, maybe at a time, and that immediately cut out a lot of competition.
Well, and we were fortunate. So here's something I would share with the audience. Like, we bought it right and then leveraged it right. It's one thing to buy it right, but it's another thing to leverage it right. So what happened was when the market turned in 08, a ton of people were losing their houses because what they were doing is buying a house, fixing it up, refinancing it, and pulling their $10,000 to $15,000 off of it and living off of it. Whereas we would buy it, fix it up. We were only trying to get what we put into it.
Right.
Like, that's all we cared about, was just getting our money back and keep on moving. So when the downturn hit, we weren't over leveraged. We still had equity. Even with the 30, 40% reduction, we still had equity. And we put things on 15-year notes. Long story short, where I'm going with that is we were with local banks, and those local banks started calling us, and they were taking back 5 houses, 10 houses. Our biggest one we had was 100 with a local bank that a third generation family just messed things up and they were needing to be rescued. And the bank, literally, we got into that no money out of pocket. It was the craziest. It was the best deal that I've ever been involved with. And we still own them to this day. So a great deal for us.
Wow. I mean, I want to dig into that just a little bit because it's a hilarious story. I mean, that's every real estate investor's dream, to get 100 houses and not put a dollar out to buy them. I mean, that's wild and crazy. Was there, you know, were they all vacant? What was the turnaround strategy on that?
Great question. So back up, what happened was a third generation family leveraged these 100 houses were free and clear. It was an old builder family up in Tipton County, which is one county over. And they leveraged the houses to build to compete against Lowe's, which was up the block. Kind of like, I think you're old enough to remember Paul Harvey, the rest of the story. Well, you can play that story out. They just couldn't compete. The prices were too high. People just go to Lowe's versus come to their hardware store. Unfortunately, that's just how it worked. So the bank foreclosed and we just came in and the bank worked it out to where we bought it. They refinanced it, put on a 15-year note, let us do interest only for 1 year. And the cash flow itself was able to pay that note and then some room. And to your point, there was 30 that were vacant at the time. Some of them been down for several years. And so we just took the next probably 2 years. It took a while because we were trying to feed off the income that was producing to fix it back up. So we took 2 years and got them back running and all that good stuff. So,
wow. One of the problems that people have had in scaling single family is just the maintenance and the upkeep on that front. And especially if you're buying 200 homes, say in Jackson here in December. So those of you listening, we're recording this on November 16th. So here in the next month, you're buying these. How did you overcome the hurdle of crews driving all over town? Hey, we got a shingle over here. We've got an air conditioner over here. Like that becomes a maintenance kind of nightmare, I would think. How do you work around that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, property management is key. And I think property managers are built to drive the city. And so back early on, we actually had people in different quadrants. This person worked with the north, this worked with the south. And at one point we had north, south, east, west. And so property managers get efficient that way by leveraging that capability. Same thing with small multifamily. We'd pick a day and go to that multifamily for 1 day and do all the work orders. There weren't quality of life or emergency. Does that make sense? You know what I mean? Like, so you're not dinging that owner and not dinging me as the owner with multiple service charges and that kind of stuff. So I think property management is the key. I think that you got to have that in place to be able to scale like that. That's one key lesson. Sorry to kick back. So the first 7-8 years, I did it all myself. So I was picking up signs. I was collecting rent. I was signing leases. We just realized on a run one time that this is crazy. If we're ever going to scale this to even bigger, we were probably, say, 500 houses, and it was two of us just doing it all. And so we just said, we got to figure this out. So we started a management company to manage others, to have fee income, to manage our own. So if you're in that world, you got to get property management, because kind of like we were joking about me being on the roof, just shame on me for blowing gutters earlier today. I'm self, you know.
What word you're looking for.
Yeah, I know what I'm looking for. Just telling on myself, basically, because I shouldn't be. That's not the best value of my time. But that's what we realized early on. That was not the best value of our time, was to sign tenant leases and handle maintenance and stuff. So if we were going to scale, we had to change.
Well, and especially with 500 houses, I mean, that's a lot of tenants to manage. That's a lot of leases to sign and a lot of yard signs to put out. And I think that's an important part to hit on here, because a lot of people see real estate as a get rich quick, and you can make a pile of money in a hurry. It can happen. But you and I were talking here a few weeks ago, and I think you said that your business has been more of a U-shape, right? And a lot of time in the bottom of that trough. Or maybe the fish hook. You just go down and stay in the bottom of the fish hook for very long time.
Yep. Trying all kinds of things, trying to make things work. And that's part of the entrepreneur's journey, right? To get out of that bottom of the U. So,
right, man, that's an encouragement to the rest of us. One, that there is a way out of that, that you do have to spend your time putting in your reps in order to climb that ladder, if you will, on the way out. Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, because you guys have built all of these companies, you've put great people in them, you have scaled them effectively, which is one, awesome. That's been a 20-year journey for you. What's the next step for you in business and real estate? What does that look like?
That's a great question. I think for me, I got a two-pronged approach. I don't know if I'll ever stop buying real estate. Mm-hmm. I think as you progress through, I mean, I think you just charts change in your asset classes, how big the project is. Like, we're buying commercial buildings and small multifamily and packages. That's kind of where my focus is kind of placed. But, and we talked about this a little bit before the show, just what I want to do is leverage that, all that years of hard work, to then buy into other businesses that might be related or unrelated to real estate, service businesses and those kind of things that could create residual income for the future. For me, the real estate journey was all about residual income. Mm. I remember sitting on a plane just laying it out how I was going to get to 300 free and clear houses by the time I was 48 years old. And that was my journey. I didn't know all the other things would start happening in the businesses create. I was focused on the 300 free and clear by 48. And now I'm just trying to figure out how to build on residual income by investing in others that have good in businesses that could create residual income. So,
right. I like that. And I like the fact that it can be related or unrelated. Is there any thought of diversification in that?
Yes, absolutely. For sure. I think we talked about this at lunch a few weeks ago, like invested in Gus's Fried Chicken. But for your listeners, like for me, it was easy to make that decision. I don't know anything about making chicken, but I know how to buy a commercial building and buy it right and look at the numbers and labor is a certain percentage. And we bought into a franchise that actually helped in that scenario. But to your point, I met with a banker last week and I hadn't really thought about it, but they're like, now you're in automobile stuff. You're in chicken business. She's like, you've done a good job of diversifying yourself out of just real estate. So I hadn't really thought of it that way. That wasn't the original goal, but that's what's turned out. So I feel like that's going to help me as I continue down that road. Because real estate ebbs and flows. I mean, we're very fortunate and blessed that we're going to have some houses we're going to buy in December. But man, I hadn't really bought anything all year. You know what I mean? Like it's been a dry year. The powder's sitting there waiting to be fired. And it's just hard to buy stuff right now. So you just got to be prepared. So that's what I'm doing. I'm preparing the gunpowder for when the real estate does change.
What are some strategies? You said that one of the things you want to do is develop residual income. How are you developing that residual income without buying yourself another job?
Great question. That's a journey that I'm on right now. So if any of your listeners have some advice, I'd love to take it. Just I'm trying to find where I can be an investor. And I just kind of had clarity on this last week where I'm an investor where I can use a balance sheet, my lines of credit, my cash, and then my kind of wisdom, knowledge, experience with manufacturing and building businesses to be a trustee advisor type role within a business that I want to look at. But I don't want to be the operator.
Right.
Does that make sense? But I can bring these four things to the table and I've got clarity around that for myself. And that brings a value. So, I mean, for our real estate guys that are out there and guys and gals that are out there doing this, like think about that. You're building a balance sheet. You're building lines of credit when you have free and clear or equity in properties. You're building up cash, hopefully at some point. And then you're building up knowledge and experience that you can now help others. So that's worth something. And so what it's worth, I'm still trying to figure that out, but that's part of my journey right now.
No, and I think that makes a heck of a lot of sense is gaining clarity about what it is you want to bring to the table and where it is that you don't want to spend or just not probably not a good use of your time.
That's right.
And like you said, making fried chicken. And for those of you who aren't aware, Gus's Fried Chicken is probably the best fried chicken you can ever eat. But you don't want to know how to make Gus's Fried Chicken.
I don't.
You want to be a balance sheet partner, bring some capital, yeah, advisory, and move on.
That's right. And that's what I'm doing. I'm just advising like even HR or hiring people, those kind of things. That's where I can add some value. But I'm not actually going to hire the people. So it's been fun. It's been a good journey.
Yeah, absolutely. When you rewind the tape of your last 20 years, is there anything that you think through that you say, man, if I could do it differently, this would be it?
I think, I mean, number one, the biggest one I always come up with, I wish I'd started a little bit earlier. I mean, 27 is young, but I could have started several years before because it's just a time journey and you can't speed up time. So you have to go through. I mean, you talk to a lot more people than I have. Like it's a 10 to 20 year journey to get through the startup. I mean, whether it's business or real estate or whatever. So I think I wish I'd started earlier. And I wish I had used better tools to hire the right people. I think early on, we were just hiring, for lack of better words, oh, you have property management experience, come on and join us. Versus we use tools like Culture Index, if you've ever heard of that, that personality profile. It's kind of like DISC and Colby. And it doesn't matter which one it is, but pick one. And we were talking about this before the show, the Dan Sullivan, like trying to find what you're best at. So you're trying to line that up. And I wish I had learned that more earlier on versus looking at a resume and, oh, you've got manufacturing experience or you got property management experience. Oh, come on board. Like, looks good. Versus really like, do you really have the detail? Do you really want to be on the phone all day long? You know what I mean? Like, does your profile of how God made you match up with what job I'm offering? And so I think we did not do a good job early on, I would say, of matching those together. And so we suffered from it. We had marginal results. sometimes losses in certain business units and stuff like that. And we can tie that back to people and performance. So,
yeah, that's interesting. I forget who it was because it's been a few months since I read it, but it's all about the hiring process. One of the things he helps you do is quantify in the book, helps you quantify the cost of a mishire.
Oh, I know which book you're talking about. Yeah, it's expensive. How much do you remember it was? 50, 100? I mean, it was
something like that. Yeah.
Think about it, because the time you're paying the HR or recruiter, the onboarding, the offboarding, if they don't work out.
Correct.
The suffering of the efficiency of within your business of something not being taken care of during that absence. It's tens of thousands, if not 50 to 100 easily. And people don't really think of it that way. We didn't think of it that way. I mean, that's just being totally honest. I just don't think we thought of it that way early on.
In the desperation, a lot of times for us as business owners, when you're in a jam, like that's the worst time to hire. I've been there one too many times. You're like, oh, crud, I need somebody now.
Yep. Like, oh, operating out of weakness is not the place you want to operate. You want to operate out of strength and be ahead of it, right? So,
right. Yeah. And so those are oftentimes when those mishires, I think, are made and you go, oh, no, what did I just do?
Yeah. So, you know it too. You know it within the first few weeks. And then you're like, oh, gosh, how do I get out of this? And then you got to figure out, I got to start over.
Yeah, or we can think we can put duct tape on it. That's a great thing to review and go, gosh, if I could redo this, that's the one thing I would do. It's the slow down to speed up idea. And I don't know that there's a way around that entirely, especially when you were hiring at volume like you guys were. It's going to happen at some point, but the fewer times you can make those mishires, the better, I would imagine.
Absolutely, for sure.
That's fantastic. When you think about the things maybe that you have done really right, what are some things that, and I know it's not in your nature to say, oh, look what I did well, but what are some things you did well that you would suggest that other listeners emulate?
I would say putting on the shortest notes as possible. I feel like that goes against the grain of what a lot of people think. If you can put it on a 10-year note, put on a 10-year note. I was thankful that I put everything on 15, 12, 10. Like,
wow.
I never was above the 15 range.
Wow.
And so it's painful as all get out. I mean, I tell you, my wife, we joke about it just recently about how there was one year I paid $5,000 out of my checking for my W-2 job to pay property taxes. She's like, what are you doing? I thought this thing was supposed to make money or at least break even.
Right.
My goodness. And I was like, babe, we just got a lot of rehabs and it's just been a tough little season. It's a $40,000 bill. I'm just paying a portion of it. But out of that though, is I'd already spent tens of thousands of equity pay down in that same period. So that's kind of how I looked at it. So in that same vein, I would say I spent a ton of time on bank relationships and still do to this day. And I think that if people come to me constantly talking about wanting to buy real estate or getting started, and I just go point them back to the bank. Have you talked to your bank? And so I have a spreadsheet. I wish I'd brought it. If I thought about it, I can send it to you, but it's got every bank that I have a relationship with. And I just keep it in my notebook. So it's always, it's like, all right, I got this deal coming up. Who would be the best one to match? Because then you can learn who their board is, who's going to approve this. If it's a bunch of farmers on the board and you're trying to buy a gas station, I'm just throwing this out as an example, it ain't going to happen. Versus a bank that's funded a lot of gas stations. They understand the numbers. They understand where it's going, what you're trying to do. So that'd be the two that I would that stick out in my mind. You know, there's many others, but a lot more failures, but that's two that come to my mind.
I think that's a great point. And just going a little deeper on that is that I don't probably think about very often how each bank has its own appetite for a specific asset class. And I've discovered that obviously in my real estate journey where one bank's like, no, absolutely not. That doesn't mean it's a bad project. You could still be sitting on a gold mine. It just means that that's not for them.
That's right.
Is there a way of somebody starting out in this business or maybe is in the single family side, is going into the commercial side? Is there a hack or a strategy someone should employ to go out? I mean, say you have no deal, but you have an idea of what you want or what you're intending on investing in. What's the best way to begin those relationships with those banks?
So I think start local. The big banks are great and they're very efficient and have good software tools and all that stuff, but start local, find several banks that you can get referred to, get with that commercial loan officer and tell them your idea. And then also I would ask them, who have you seen be successful in this business? I mean, I don't think we realize how much of a plethora of information or knowledge that our bankers have.
Right.
They look at, that's all they do. Think about it. All they do is look at deals all day.
Right.
So who is the most successful and why? And I have to have names, but who has defaulted, bankrupt, quit, sold, whatever that is, and why, and then try to get an intro to the person that has done well and try to get that connection. That could be an instant mentor. So that's my nugget that I feel like has been a secret sauce for me that I don't mind sharing. Like, I just spent a ton of time with bankers.
That's brilliant. Yeah, I love that. That's an encouragement to me as well to get out and do more of that. Certainly, that's a piece. The axe is not as sharp as it should be in my tool shed for that side of the business.
Well, you just have to be intentional, to your point. Just got to make it a focus. So like early on, I don't have to do as much now, but early on, to your point, like with your newer investors, man, make you a list and get those banking, like say you just start with three, but then make it a point every month, call them, put on your calendar and just check base. And I would say a few things. Hey, what's going on? How's your lending going? Who can I send you that you want? So like get that whole give or take. I want to be a giver every conversation. So who can I send you that will make you more successful or more money for you in the bank? So that's not all about you. And really, truly try to send them people, try to connect them. And then just tell them what you're trying to do and ask for guidance and what do they need from you to make it happen. So I did that for a long, long time. Once a month, I would touch base with the banks. And 20 years later, I mean, I got bankers that I can call and get a deal done in 24 hours. I say deal done, looked at, approved, and moved forward. So you can't beat that. I mean, that's a blessing for sure. So
absolutely. Dan, I've really enjoyed this. It's been a blast hearing really about your journey, how you started out, transitioned into real estate, the things you've learned, the companies you've grown. We didn't touch on at least half of them, but
that's all right. Save for another day.
Yeah, absolutely. You've done a lot, and it's certainly a pleasure having you on the show. Let's jump here into the final few questions, if you don't mind.
Okay.
First one's this. If you'd help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be, and how would you avoid it?
I would say I go back to my original one from 10 minutes ago, just over-leveraging, trying to make a deal work.
Yeah.
So take the emotion out of it. There's other deals. And I'm bad about this because once I cut my claws into a deal, I'm trying to make it to the finish line. Like that's just my personality.
Right.
So that would be take the emotion out of it, stick to the numbers, stick to your gut. I think we all have guts. And I would say every time I've gone against my gut on trying to make it work, it's just tough on the other side. So that would be probably my advice for today.
Yeah. I have a donut for the number of times I've gone against my gut and it's worked out. So
yeah, zero.
Zero. Yep.
Or if it did, it's not near what you thought it was going to be.
So. No. I think that's brilliant. I love that, especially coming from an engineer. So you're super analytical.
That's true.
And,
and still went against my gut.
So. Still went against your gut. That's fantastic. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
So I spent a ton of time in one of the poorest zip codes in Memphis. And I just feel like I think it's a lot of our responsibility. You know, we talk about the economic disparity between rich and poor and all that stuff. And it's like, my question is always back, like, okay, the government does help, but what are we doing about it?
Right.
And so that's kind of my challenge to your listeners and to myself, just to constantly say, what can I do differently today than yesterday of like helping the city be better? Because all we have is time. And I feel like that's something that I want to pour into is like just help others to get out of poverty and trying to find a better way. And it might just be one person at a time, but to me, it's a generational deal. That's a whole nother podcast around just my journey there. Not think I could help, but I mean, you think about one person, you could help change their lives, sisters, brothers, daughters, sons, you're creating a new tree that just takes a different path. So that would be, did I answer your question?
Yeah, 100%. I love that. Last question for you, Dan, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Man, I just say my email, danbutler901@gmail.com, or my cell, that's the only number I have, 901-289-7888.
Dan, thank you so much. Appreciate your time today. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, man, thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.